Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
You're not doing dinners on me to like.
No, I'm not doing a gotcha piece. No, not at all.
Yeah, what sort of cocktail do you want? And also, how do you feel about immigration? Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week we have star of stage and screen and one of my gay ass heroes, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, on the podcast. You watched him for 11 years on the hit television show Modern Family, where he played Mitch, the neurotic gay lawyer married to the dramatic queen Cameron, and you may have listened to him on the cast recording of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee while you were closeted through high school. But enough about me. He also hosts the podcast Dinners on Me, where a new star-studded guest joins him at a literal restaurant where they gab over amazing meals, and it truly is an incredible pod that you must listen to. Some fun business. If you want to win one of three gay-ass shirts, head to the gay-ass Instagram and enter to win by tomorrow. That's Thursday, May 23rd at midnight. Because if you win, you can choose from any of the gay-ass shirts. We have the Protect Character Actresses shirt, Girlina, Body Hair Advocates of America, and Fagatrini. So you gotta go. Go and win, bitch. But we're going to get into this episode with Jesse Tyler Ferguson, where he dishes about his recent appearance on Watch What Happens Live, DMing with his now husband on Twitter.com, and the way that Jesse likes to be flirted with. If you enjoy, tag me on Instagram at Eric Wills, and go thank Jesse for coming on. I mean, this man is such a fucking mensch. Jesse goddamn Tyler fucking Ferguson. I'm taking a moment of silence for the teenage me who listened to you driving my car, and I'm telling him it happened, babe. You got Jesse Tyler Ferguson on your gay ass pod, and Jesse, can I thank you for being here and being queer? Absolutely stunning for me.
Thank you. Wait, why were you listening to me in your car?
I would record you sleeping and then play it. No, I would naturally. I was listening to
At the 25th Annual.
Yes.
Hun. She was and is a theater girl, and Jesse, you have lived the GDD, the goddamn dream, and I've got a list of questions for you. So your podcast, Dinners on Me, you asked the question so beautifully, and I mean that. I've been listening. I love this pod, but it's time to turn the tabes, Jesse, and I've got a list for you. Are you buckled the brunch up?
I'm just trying to keep up. Buckled the brunch up, list of faves. Everything's abbreviated, I assume.
Yee. Okay, so the first thing we're going to get into, I love to start controversially, and we're going to begin with you just did Watch What Happens Live with a guest of this podcast, John Early, who was on all of 3 weeks ago. Jesse, Andrew Cohen asked you about the worst thing to do when hosting a dinner party, and you said the answer of not having dimmable lights.
Yeah.
Now, Jesse,
yeah.
My question is, did you inherit the gay gene of being a gorgeous gay dinner party host, or was it learned?
It was learned. It's a learned task. It's a learned skill. My parents definitely hosted when they were, you know, my age now, but you know, they weren't, it wasn't chic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've dined in too many bright places to know that that's just not a fun way to dine. You need to set the mood. I mean, I'm one of those people that like, I have those, the Lutron lights where you could press a button and like it does like certain things. I label them like cocktail, dinner, like in the bathtub. It's like bath time, you know, relaxation. Yeah. It's all that. So it's something I've learned.
We love that because it is aspirational, because I have not a lick of taste, not a lick of ability, but I am lucky to be married to someone who was born with the gene, and he just bought us new lights for our, we have an overhead light on our dining room table that is harsh, Lena, and we have just gotten two new lights that make it much more of a dimmable vibe. So whenever you want to go to a two bed, two bath, Jesse, you're invited, and I think he's going to turn it out for you.
I see that you have some sort of artistic nudes in the background too. Is this your apartment that we're looking at?
We're looking at the two bed, two bath in the flesh.
And
you know, when Matt first bought these photos, I said, are they supposed to look like that? And then he said yes. And then I said, oh, I like them. So, you know, I'm, again, the lack of taste, I sometimes have to question the decisions, but I think they're gorge. And
they are gorgeous.
Thank you. I wish I could give you a full tour. What I'm not going to show you, and this is not a joke, what I'm not going to show you is the glass case next to my desk of the ruby slippers that sit and stare at us while we sleep with each other or others.
Wait. These aren't the actual ruby slippers, though.
No, but they're close. Like 2 or 3 years into dating, he purchased these for an unknown amount of money off of a gay guy on the internet that he met. And they're very, very close to the actual. That's why he paid so much. But to this date in May, I do not know how much he spent. And we've been together for 11 years.
Well, they're under glass, so it's got to be something high.
No, it is high. And whenever we bring over a guest star, I love to turn to him when they say, what is that? And then as he starts speaking, I go in for the kiss. I'm kidding. Yeah. So the other thing that happened on Watch What Happens Live is Andy Cohen asked you and John Early, like, the last time you've been on Grindr, and you said, never, Jesse. What a brag.
I know. Well, didn't I say that I had joined it at the very beginning?
Maybe. Oh, maybe you did. Okay. So, well, the clip that was on YouTube.com must have stopped there. But because you and Justin have been together for... Right.
We've been married. I'll be 11 years in July. So the thing is, Grindr was just starting when I started dating him, or maybe it was like a year before, but I do remember I had, maybe this didn't make it onto the YouTube clip that you watch, but I did join it and then quickly realized, but also it was so early in Grindr that I don't even think the community recognized it as like a quick hookup app. I think it was like,
right,
its intentions were good at the beginning. Not that they're not good now, but listen, like, they were more pure at the beginning. It was truly what I thought was going to be a dating app, and it was the first app that generated people by location. So I think, you know, it was just a matter of time before, you know, the gays were going to figure out how to like really use this to their advantage. And it just sort of seemed like it wasn't for me, so I got off of it pretty quick. But there was a time when I was a presence on it, but I did sort of notice, I was like, well, there's a lot of people without their faces, and it's just a lot of you know, chin to belly button shots. And I'm like, I'm not sure if that's
the vibe, your current vibe. No, I was actually the exact same way when I first logged on to the app, because before meeting Matt, I had never met someone from it. Matt and I met literally at an audition for Fiddler on the Roof. We'll put a pin on that. But I'd seen a lot of the facelessness. And I think it, like, at the beginning, it did lean into a bit of a shame sitch. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think we were like, more gays were pretending what we were there for, or maybe what we deserved. And now I think it's much more sort of the 1970s of Grindr now, which is like, we're here, we're queer, who's on my cornier. The final thing I just want to bring up, because we're both podcast gays and we're on a literal podcast right now, Andy Cohen gave a word of warning about podcasts when you talked about wanting to have Quinta Brunson on. He was like, He's like, he really, and then you went, someone's been burned by podcasts.
Yeah, obviously Andy's had some bad experiences on podcasts. I think that, you know, certainly, you know, it's interesting because I remember when I first started in Modern Family and people started picking apart little things I said, either in jest and like they become clickbait. And it was really frustrating. And so I think Quint is experiencing that right now because Abbott Elementary is, you know, well, it's been on for about 3 years now, but like, I think she's still at the beginning of that sort of meteoric rise that she's having. And, you know, she's only going to continue to rise and rise and rise because I think she's incredibly talented. But like, I can understand where she's like hesitant to put anything out there that's not fully controllable. But, you know, I mean, I get it and I still want to have her on my podcast.
And you will. I mean, similarly, the fear that people have expressed when it comes to podcasts. Now, I'm talking more from the perspective of like having the guests on, and I hope one day to be momentarily canceled by something dumb I say about avocados. But like when I first started the podcast, I was less good about being like, whatever is said, we can absolutely edit out if you want it to. And one of my first guests called me right after he recorded, and he had said something about the unhoused community that he thought was just like was borderline, and I could hear the panic in his voice, and then that made me start to panic. So the second that happened, I was like, okay, I need people to know that like we're good, it's all good, and if it's not all good, we'll make it good. And I think you express the exact same thing on Watch What Happens, which is like, you're not doing dinners on me to like,
no, I'm not doing a gotcha piece. Not at all.
Yeah. What sort of cocktail do you want? And also, how do you feel about immigration?
Totally. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
It's more neutral. It's more neutral than that for sure.
It's also funny. I think that when I was listening to you talk about the grinder of it all, and the outspokenness of it all, it reminded me of that amazing story about how you and Justin, your husband, met, where you and I believe had asked him out, and then he had been in a relation, and you said, I'm not interested in making friends, basically, when he was like, let's go out for as friends.
Yeah.
And so not only were you having a directness there, which we love, but also I believe you started messaging on Twitter.
I think it was Twitter. It must have been. It had to have been. It's so long ago. It's hard to remember. But yeah, it was. Yeah. I think it was Twitter. And I think even like maybe the early enough days of Twitter where Justin had such a low following, like he probably even gave me his phone number in an actual message and not even like a direct message. Like, I think he actually just posted his phone number.
A public message?
Yeah, I think so. I do. I think so. But I remember somehow I got his number and we ended up texting, and that's, you know, how I realized he was in a relationship and he wanted to go out as friends. And I said, well, no, I have friends that I've known for years that I don't see enough of. Like, I don't need to like have another ambiguous relationship with a guy who's 10 years younger than me, who's in a relationship. I was like, no. It's fine. But
have you always been that direct?
No, it's something I've learned. When Justin and I met, I had been on a string of very ambiguous dates that I wasn't sure if they were actual dates or not. And I was just getting really fed up with it. And I remember one time, and actually the tables were turned on me. I was with this guy and I thought we were being super casual, and such a great guy. And I'm friends with him still, but I remember him ran into a friend of ours or a friend of his on the street outside of a coffee shop. And he introduced me as his boyfriend. And I was like, bah, 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 whoa. So, I mean, I was the one who was obviously not being. So, I mean, I had been on both sides of it, basically. So I really wanted to set the ground rules, you know, the parameters.
You were also probably at an age where you were like, you knew what you wanted. Yeah. You knew what you deserved. And my dream side business is being like a gay yenta, where I get the gals together and they either find love or D or whatever they want. And a lot of my close duties in LA are single gay guys who are such catches. And I feel like I'm with some of the Jessies of your scenario when you met Justin.
Yes.
So it's like they know what they want. They know. Can you, if you were to help my business and help the single gays or gals out there who know what they want and deserve, any tips or anything that you did that put the energy into the universe that said you were ready for a gorgeous husband like the Justin Makita?
Oh, God. I keep telling Justin, I was like, I thank God we're not single now, because I don't know how to date in this current climate. That I feel like everything's changed. All the rules have changed so much. I really wish I had some great advice for you on that one. I mean, I do think that, you know, tapping into your friends' recommendations is a good thing. I think that they're a little bit more, they're vetted, so to speak.
Yes.
So I do think that, you know, finding friends who have friends that you casually meet. I do think it's important, though, to make yourself clear when it is like a one-on-one situation, like, mm-hmm. like be like, I'm calling this, like you could say, I'm calling this a date. I'm taking you out. Like it is what it, like, no pressure. It doesn't have to go well, but like, it's not just like a random, like. The thing is, we all know what it is. It's just sometimes people pretend. They're like, oh, I didn't know that was a date. Yes, you did.
But the thing that I find so like refreshing about you, and I think that this is like why I was dreaming of this moment, and it's going exactly as well as I wanted it to, which is that you are so, there's like a disarmedness of honesty that I think I love to subscribe to as well. And I think people really should in a dating scenario, but also in sort of like in any scenario. And I think even sometimes with my family back home, I come in more honest than they're used to being around each other. And mm-hmm. I think that is not even a read on my family. It's just that, like, I think maybe even it's as a gay person, you're like you've spent so much time hiding that by the time you're not.
Yeah.
You're like, can we just please say what it is?
That's a great point. And I think you're absolutely right, for sure.
Well, then, Jesse, I do want to ask you the famous podcast question with that segue, which is, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Jesus. I don't think, you know, it might've been my mom's Mervyn catalogs from, you know, because I would wait for these catalogs to come and I would just like rip out the underwear ads and save those. So maybe that's the reason. Yeah, I mean,
those underwear catalogs were huge.
Yeah, or like, what was the other one? What was the one that they also sold, like vague sort of pirate outfits? Do you know what I'm talking about?
My mind first went to Party City Halloween.
It's not far off. Not far off, my friend. I'm looking it up on my phone right now. I just typed in pirate outfits men's catalog. And this is not what I'm looking for. Oh gosh, it's going to come to me at some point. There was this really ridiculous catalog. It was almost like fetish wear for men. And I don't remember. I don't know why it was coming to my house. Maybe my dad had ordered something off of it at one point, and all of a sudden he was on the subscriber list.
Yeah, maybe he had a singular hoop earring, or he loved a cravat.
It wasn't just pirate outfits. It wasn't just pirate outfits. Oh, God.
Maybe the peg legs were on sale. I don't know.
Anyway, that catalog would come in and I'd be like, oh, what is this? I mean, it was like a whole new world for me.
Do you find yourself whenever you see a swashbuckler?
International Mail. It's called International Mail.
We got there.
Someone is going to be like, someone, first of all, listen to this episode, is screaming International Mail the entire time we're having this conversation.
And when you say someone, you mean at least a dozen are gay guys in their car going,
International Mail. Yep, International Mail.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And listen, I'm listening and I'm learning and I'm looking on google.com. Holy shit.
Do you see?
Oh, I see. Oh, wow. I mean, you
it's
know what's
so
funny
80s
about these?
Too.
I was going to say it's very 80s and very also like 80s. It's deeply entrenched in the male physique that needs to sure be muscled, but a single hair would go against the laws of international crime.
Yes. Very smooth, catalogs. Very tan. Mm-hmm.
So do you agree that body hair is gross and that I should feel bad?
No, I think, do you have body hair? And that's so wonderful. No, it's so great. Justin, when I first met him, he would shave his chest because, you know, he was 24 and he was like that. He was holding on to his twinkdom. And I was like, please, please stop doing that. Please. You're so handsome with the body hair. I love it.
And did he listen?
Yeah, he's good. Yeah. Sometimes he'll trim it up a little bit, which is fine, but you know.
Listen, I'm not gonna be an extremist either far on either side of the political spectrum, but I will say that Save the Bush, and if you are ever interested, one of the merch pieces for Gay Ass Podcast is a shirtless hairy man that says Body Hair Advocates of America. So
there you go.
I will make sure that Justin knows that we're spreading the good gospel. Now when we think about you as a young person, international male is thankfully hitting your Albuquerque home's porch. And you are this shy kid that was super into being on stage. Mm-hmm. What do you think it was about the theater that even though you were a shy, dare I say, introvert, you knew it was your place?
I mean, part of it was I just really didn't have a good friendship circle in school. And so I think the moment I went into that first acting, I hesitate to even call it a class because it was just, you know, it was like kids playing theater games.
Zip, zap, zap.
Yeah. But it was, I just immediately felt very welcomed. Like it's like all of the weird quirks that we were sort of trying to hide to keep kids from bullying us were the things that were celebrated in this class. So I just really felt like I could breathe finally. And it was less about like actually being on stage and like finding a character and finding backstory, more like just the fact that I felt completely at home with these people. And then from that, you know, the thing that we were doing was putting on a play. And I found that like, well, I'll do anything that these people want to do with me because they're all so creative and so wonderful. And I feel at home with them and like I agree myself with them. And so from that, I think my love of actually acting sprung from just feeling secure amongst a group of my own peers for a little while.
Oh my God, that like really takes me back and makes me feel a little emosh, because I think I had the exact same feeling of like the safety that I craved that I wasn't getting anywhere else. Yeah. And I love the way you say that, because sure, you grew into the love of acting. You grew into wanting to be a part of the industry that is, dare I say, devastating. However, you first found that love of it just because you were like safe to be yourself. And I remember an exact moment when I was in eighth grade in a theater class. I remember getting a reaction from some stupid thing I did. And I remember thinking, oh my God, the less self-conscious you are about who you are and the more you actually allow yourself to be stupid, which is how I kind of, you know, framed it at the time, the more you allowed yourself to look stupid, which maybe was code for gay or whatever you were.
Right.
I was like, the better you are received. And it was so encouraging to know that I could have a positive reaction to being as weird or as really gay as I was. And that little black box was the place to do it.
Right. No, for sure. I think, you know, there's... there's lots of ways to approach acting, but like I think for me that the thing that feels most secure and most correct is that I'm working from a place of truth, and I think that, you know, being exactly what you said, you know, open to living in that truth and being okay with who I am only helps me do the thing that I ended up realizing which is acting. But I think there's a lot of people who also, you know, love acting because they don't want to deal with the truth and like they'd rather be other people. So I think it can go two different ways. So
That's very true.
But I do like, you know, becoming other people and living other people's lives and pretending to, you know, or embodying people that I that are part of history. Like I think that's all really exciting. And but I think all of that for me, it springs from a place of truth and me being comfortable with who I am first.
Yeah, no, that I really resonate with that. And I think that when you talk about this stuff, and by the way, I want to say one of the episodes that I heard you talk about this was a podcaster that I really love is Guy Raz, the Great Creators podcast. And oh my God, it was such a good interview. If anybody here has not listened to it, I highly recommend, because you talked basically about how you were, you know, like you said here, you were spending recess alone. You were sort of in self-protection mode. And then you were able to let theater be a vessel for you coming out of your shell and feeling supported. And I do love that, you know, Guy Raz is clearly an amazing host. He is not as much of a theater queen as some of the others. So I love his, some of his questions like, were you wearing a Phantom of the Opera mask to school? Right. I love that question. But like he really leaned into one of my favorite stories you told, which is how you and John Cameron Mitchell, of course, of Hedwig fame, went to the same high school. Can you give us like a SparkNotes version of that herstory of what happened?
Yeah. So John Cameron Mitchell, the creator of Hedwig, went to St. Pius, the 10th high school in Albuquerque, New Mexico, about, I don't know, 10 years before I did, maybe less, maybe eight. But he graduated before I did. And my drama teacher at, or my English teacher rather, who also taught drama on the side, because we really didn't have a drama program. But she told me that, you know, John Cameron Mitchell used to be one of her students. I was obsessed with The Secret Garden, which is the musical he was doing it at that time on Broadway. And so I got his address and I wrote him a fan letter and I said that I was going to be moving to New York and I left him my phone number and he ended up calling me at home in Albuquerque and saying, you know, when you come to New York, please reach out to me. And one of the things that I forgot that I did though, when in that letter, I slipped him a picture of me, of my senior year photo. And I was indeed holding a Phantom of the Opera mask in my senior year picture. It was the prop that I brought with me for my photos. And so of course, you know, John gets this sweet letter from a kid in Albuquerque, his old hometown, and, you know, with his phone number on it. And, but then there's also this ridiculous photo of this, you know, 17-year-old kid with the Phantom of the Opera mask. And so he put it on his refrigerator and it sat there for many years. And about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years after I moved to New York, I was with my friend Miriam Shore, who was his co-star in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And she's like, would you want to have lunch with me and my friend John? Of course, I remembered writing this fan letter to John. I vaguely remembered also including a photo, but I kind of blocked it out. I was like, oh my God, I hope I didn't do that. That's really embarrassing. But I assumed he would never remember this. So I went out to lunch with Miriam and John and got to the point where we were getting ready to pay the bill, and the bill came, and John, instead of putting a credit card down, put down the picture of me in the Phantom of the Opera mask. And I was like, what, how, what? I didn't know what to say. And Miriam was like, what is this? What's going on? And John said, this has been on my refrigerator for the past, you know, 8 years or however long it was. And he just thought it was so sweet. He thought it was so sweet. And the thing is, I was such a fan of his, obviously, from The Secret Garden. But then, you know, after Hedwig, I became even more of a fan of his and just thought he's such an incredible artist. And that whole character and story sprung from his head. And I really admire him greatly. So the fact that the universe sort of brought us together at that lunch table all those years later is really ironic and fun. But it's also... it also just sort of speaks to how small the community is, but like circling back to how open the theater community is. I mean, John got that letter from me, got that photo, doesn't know me at all. I mean, he could have thrown that away, tossed it aside. The picture could have been lost, but instead there was something about it that really touched him. And he kept that photo on his refrigerator of a complete stranger for so long. And then I don't know, I just love that we finally came together after.
Yeah, there's something to me about that moment and a lot of moments I think in your life and career that really do feel like the universe is doing her thing, that was like, it absolutely is because you have this genuine positive energy. John is obviously this incredible performer and person who saved that photo. But I think that there was something about the path of your life. It was meant, you were meant to be connected. You were, that credit card was in that moment meant to be little 17-year-old ginger you with a Phantom of the OP mask. And what inspires me about John Cameron Mitchell and you, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, is the tenacity that you both have had with being these queer performers that, sure, have been given opportunities by a lot of people with great projects, but also the agency that you've taken with your own life to create the life you want personally and professionally, when it comes to either advocacy, when it comes to having a family, when it comes to doing this podcast, when it comes to all of the different projects. I am learning at this point in my life that running with your own ideas and agency only lets the universe reward you in return. And so
that's nice.
One of the things, of course, and the other thing that really inspires me about you is going into the Putnam County Spelling Bee sitch, which you also talked about on Guy's podcast, is how you talked about how, like, you know, you might not have been considered like a Patti LuPone, the most incredible singer of your generation, but you were able to originate this role. You were able to have this career on Broadway. And my question for you is, because I myself also performed in musical theater, I'm, you know, now in LA trying to make my dreams come true and make a living wage. However, was any part of your theater journey into your Hollywood journey, were you told ever that because of, let's say, you weren't a Newsies dancer or a Patti singer or whatever, did you ever feel like the world was telling you to limit yourself and then you just use your own tenacity to create your own career? How did you get out from the limits that might have been projected onto you?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, when you go to theater school, they really do want you to be a triple threat and be really great at everything. And it became very clear to me early on as I was trying to, you know, struggle through dance auditions and, or, you know, sing roles that were out of my range. It became very clear to me that I could either move forward doing a lot of things really mediocre or just a few things really well. And I decided to focus my efforts onto to leaning into what I knew I did well. And, you know, I knew I had a lot of quirky qualities that set me apart from other people, but also limited me from doing other things that I always dreamed of doing. Like, I wanted to be in the ensemble of Les Miserables. Like, that was my favorite musical, I was not built for that show. Like, it's not meant for me. I'm not for that show. Although ironically, I did sing Master of the House with said Patti LuPone as Thénardier, and she did Madame Thénardier at Carnegie Hall. So it did come back.
What?
The universe did say, actually, you can.
See, I'm telling you.
I know.
Universe girl knows what she's doing. Was that for a Patti show?
No, it was, I can never say the name of the composers of Les Miserables and Miss Saigon. The Schoenberg.
Jean-Claude.
Yeah. It was a concert of all their music. So it was like Lea Salonga and Patti LuPone. And, you know, they did basically stuff from Les Mis and Miss Saigon because they really didn't write too much besides that.
Well, and listen, why would they? When you have You Are Sunlight. I keep, as a host of this podcast, I keep adding to the list of things that made me gay. And I would say I just discovered in this very episode with you, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, that Lea Salonga is in the top 15.
Oh, yeah. Did you watch that documentary about her being cast in Miss Saigon?
Of course I did. And when and the reason that I had the access to it is right when YouTube started. Literally right when it started. That was one of the first clips I remember seeing on YouTube.com.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Can you imagine having a party and rewatching that? Because, you know, it's, I mean, like, I'm sure people listening remember, but anyone who doesn't, it's Lea Salonga and like her like best friend auditioning for the role, the star, and they're fully, you know, 11 and a half, whatever, they're like 17, 16. Yeah. And there's Lea Salonga sitting at that piano.
I mean, we all knew when we were watching that, we're like, oh, she's going to get it. And then her friend, who's also very talented, I think was her understudy and then was on the ensemble. So.
Yeah, maybe she sang the movie in my mind or something.
Yeah, my God.
Yeah. That's right. Wow. Well, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, I really wore the CD-ROM out, and all of your parts, and I got to see, unfortunately, not you on Broadway, saw the tour, but listen, I was like a teenager in Missouri.
Oh, I think I probably know who you saw then. It's probably Stanley. He's very good, if you saw Stanley.
I'm sure. Great kisser, too. But the other songs in the show, I think, became like gay anthems, like the I Love You song. Come on now.
Yeah, well, it's a big belting number. Yeah.
It's a big belting number. We love My Unfortunate Erection. We love... Also, I shout out to William Finn, who I would go to the same synagogue as he...
Oh, no way.
When I was living in New York, and every high holiday service, I don't know if you know this, but they would sing a William Finn song in this like high Jewish... highly important Jewish moment.
Is that on the Upper West Side?
So yeah, there's well, they now have a location in Chelsea, but they would do the huge high holiday services at Javits Center, and it would always be like Sally Wilford singing. God, what would she would sing like the same William Finn song. I would bring at the time my new boyfriend, who was now my husband, and I'd be like, "No, you're gonna love it. William Finn is there," and then they would sing like one specific
Infinite Joy.
I forget which song. It might have been that. It might have been the second
Passover?
We finish, I'll come up with it, but Passover, surprisingly enough. It was not even a Jewish song. It was just like it was probably for the sad holiday. It was probably for like Yom Kippur. And,
I'm Breaking Down but from falsettos,
It was I'm Breaking Down, exactly. But Putnam County Spelling Bee, huge for me. And then we obviously have to have a quick moment for the Modern Family, Sitch, because again, the universe did her thing. You have this Broadway career. Did you, before I get into specifics, I mean, you were fully made your Broadway debut when you were like, again, so stupid young. It was like on the town at what? Like, how old were you?
21.
21?
Yeah.
So 21. You're very, at that point, did you have the smarts to know that you were going to hope to get this Broadway career under your belt, go to Hollywood, get the sitcom, and then come back? What was that? Was that the plan? Or did it happen just sort of organically?
No. I never thought I would ever be on TV.
Really?
No. In fact, I didn't even realize there was callbacks for television. Like when you audition and, you know, you get to come back and audition again, you know, that I would get callbacks for theater projects, but I would never get a callback for anything on TV, commercial, nothing. And I was like, oh, I guess they just don't do callbacks. And it's like, no, I'm just not getting, I'm just not getting the callbacks. But ironically, it was that performance in Spelling Bee that some producers came and saw and put me in their sitcom from that performance. So it wasn't Modern Family. It was a show that I did before Modern Family called The Class, but that was the show that brought me out to Los Angeles. And so I auditioned for it, but they initially saw me from doing Leif Koneybaer and Spelling Bee. So
and did you get call? Was there a callback for Modern Family? And you said to yourself, wait a minute.
Yeah, they do exist. Yeah, no, and then I stayed out in LA after that. The first sitcom sort of fizzled, and then Modern Family came around, and at that point it was it's so interesting because it's like once you've been given opportunity to do TV, all of a sudden people like accept that that's something you can do. But if I remember when I first got my first TV job, it was sort of that era of like you sort of stayed in your own lane, like theater performers. Only to the theater, and there was really no crossover. You know, you would rarely see television stars or movie stars coming to do Broadway. It sort of felt like it was them slumming it a bit. But even like within the theater community, I feel like if you did musicals, you weren't really considered, you know, talented. Well, I wouldn't say talented enough, but like, are you know, you weren't considered appropriate for, you know, straight plays or you know, just dramas or Shakespeare. Like there was just very little crossover. Everyone sort of had their boxes. So it was exciting when not only I got an opportunity to do a TV show, but then when I got to come back, I was able to sort of like do other things in theater that I hadn't been able to do before, namely Shakespeare and straight plays and things that weren't musical theater. So it was, I don't know. I think these are much different now. I see a lot of crossover. There's so many people who I admire on stage, like Audra McDonald and Sutton Foster and Annalee Ashford and Randrew Reynolds, all these people who are great theater stars who are having incredible theater careers or television careers as well. But it was not always like that.
When you went from doing theater in New York, you go to Los Angeles, your first sitcom, for whatever reason, didn't hit. Modern Family does. You make more money than you were making doing Broadway. What was your first big purchase?
Well, I paid off my student loan. That was the first thing.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
I paid off a student loan and then I ended up buying a house, a small little house. It was just a little 2-bedroom bungalow in Silver Lake. And that was my first big purchase. Yeah.
And was that before you met Justin?
Yes. Right before I met him. He moved in while I was still sort of fixing it up. So he was making design choices. And, you know, I was just started to date this guy. And then he moves in like probably a little earlier than I expected him to, like maybe 6 months. And he's sort of giving his input for like design stuff. I'm like, whoa, let's slow the roll. This is my house.
Oh, I love a power struggle between two gay men with an eye for design.
Right? Right. And I mean, I won, of course, because it was...
I was going to say, your name on the deed, huh?
Yeah, exactly. But the next place we bought together was truly our place together. And, you know, yeah, I remember that being like the first big purchase, I think, was that home.
It's so amazing. And of course, more than just your paycheck, the most amazing part is you playing this like out loud. I mean, the Lion King reveal of the child, I don't even remember what year. The show started,
2010 or 20. Yeah, I think 2010. Or 2009, I think.
2009. So yeah. I had like only been out for a very, you know, maybe a year.
Yeah.
And I think to see, you know, obviously the two of you in this married couple of like, you're this, you know, a little more neurotic lawyer. Mm-hmm. And then... you know, your husband being exactly what I... First of all, I'm also from Missouri, and so Missouri was huge for me. But it really was and still remains such an important thing that I saw then. And I think it's only gotten... It started this amazing movement of queer characters that showed so many colors of us. And I think that your character really, you know, showed that gay people are... also really in their heads a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I loved how neurotic he was. He was fun. I find really serious people to be very funny. And I just you gotta lighten up.
You said I forget in which interview, but you said that because you played a lawyer on Modern Family, a lot of people think you're smart. But oh no, it's on your own podcast. You said that with Jinx Monsoon.
Oh yeah.
That because you played a lawyer, people think you're smart, but you didn't take college.
Yeah,
you
I didn't know take a darn college. Thing. Yeah, I really did it. Went right to acting school. Yeah.
Do you get rightfully hit on a lot when you're at gay bars?
I don't think so. First of all, it's been a while since I've actually been in a gay bar, but Justin and I, our favorite thing to do for a while was when we were traveling. It's harder now with kids because usually we're traveling with our children. But before, we would love to like go to the local gay bar and just like see what the situation was. And I love being recognizable. I love that I can be like in terms of like representation and that people like look up to me. I love that. But there comes this other element with it where like people will be looking at you and, you know, 15 years ago, I would have thought, oh, they're checking me out. They think I'm cute. But now it's just like my mind goes like, oh, they just probably just recognize me from television. Oh. So even if someone is trying to flirt with me, I would never think that they are. I just, it's a bummer because I would like to be flirted with still. I mean, who doesn't like to be flirted with? I mean, Justin gets so excited if like he's out with some friends. He's like, oh, I got hit on tonight. He gets so excited. I'm like, oh, I forgot what that felt like to be hit on. Cause I don't think anyone.
I remember that.
But like they'll approach me, but I assume immediately that it's just because, you know. They're a fan.
I'm going to say with full certainty that you are very much being hit on. You just have I will say with love, a bit of an understandable complex. And for future run-ins with people, me included, what is your favorite compliment to receive when you're being flirted with?
You're much more handsome in person. Although then I'm thinking, well, was I not handsome on TV? Yeah.
I don't know, but maybe you're more secure than I am because I'd be like, well, I'm just going to go and pop a Xanax and look at my hair loss.
I really like it when people truly have no... I've met a few people who really truly didn't know who I was, and that's always really nice. So if you want to like really impress me, you can at least pretend that
just
you don't
talk
know
to you like, yeah, okay, yeah. You, oh, hey, do you work in
you're
tech? Like,
you're cute. What do you do? Yeah. Yeah.
What do you do? I love that. Because we had a quick dip into Dinners on Me, let's go full tilt. This podcast is not only a podcast that interviews, the guests that you have are stupid. Like what? Are you doing the reach outs here? I mean, the list isn't. Kristen Bell has done it. Niecy Nash, Bets We Love, Jesse Williams, of course, your Take Me Out co-star. Jinx just did it recently. Mm-hmm. Are you at the helm of the strategic guest booking? Because, hon, she's killing it.
I have a list of dream guests, and I'm very proud that we've gotten so many of them on. There's been people who've said no, though. Like, you know, I think a lot of people just don't like to do podcasts. And there's been some people that have come and pitched themselves to us. And I've been excited to, you know, get to know people that weren't necessarily on my radar. I love doing the research on people. So that's always a really fun part for me, because if I don't really know too much about them, I do come into the conversation with a pretty good understanding about who they are, because I will do my research.
Well, the podcast is such a great, what I love about it so much is the best types of podcasts are, of course, when people say, I feel like I'm listening to my friends. I feel like I'm a part of my friend's conversation. And you are literally at the restaurant with the two of you. And we hear, it's almost, and forgive the reference, because this is said with all the respect, and it's coming from a very genuine place of, you know, on The Real Housewives, when they always, we always have to hear their drink order. We always have to hear what they're getting. It's like a staple of the show. When I hear you say in this most recent episode, do you want the server asked, do you want a flavor almond milk latte? And you went, no, I just want it just straight up. I'm like, wow, I know what Jesse Tyler Ferguson is drinking.
Yeah. I
can picture the foam.
Yeah.
Go on. I think it puts us in the middle of the restaurant. We hear the silverware. We are a part of the meal. And who does not want, I mean, it's like, you know, the age old question. If you could share a meal with someone, you know, who would it be? And we're sharing it with you and Jinx and you and, you know, all these amazing people. So
it's a really great concept. I really do love it. Chelsea Peretti was on recently, and she was like, it feels like it's an NPR field piece, you know, because you hear all the jangling. Yeah. And she's like, it feels like we're doing an NPR field piece, which I love that description of it. It's great. I'm having a really great time. Of course, I love, you know, eating out and having meals. And so, like, I get to try a lot of these restaurants that have been on my list for a while. You know, George Takei, he's my guest this week. And he took me out to one of his favorite places, which is Japan House. It's this incredible sushi restaurant above Hollywood Boulevard. And it was literally, you know, just right above where his Hollywood star is. So, like, I was dining with George Takei from, you know, Star Trek, and right below us was, you know, his handprints, and, you know, seared into the sidewalk of the Chinese Grauman Theater. And we were having sushi together at his recommendation. So I love also learning about my guests and, like, what a lot of times I let them take the lead on which restaurant to pick. And it ends up being a really special moment.
It's a very, I think, vulnerable and personal experience to share a meal with someone.
Yeah.
And I think, like, to do it with a microphone situated with you, it's ups the ante, I think, of maybe the stakes a bit. But obviously, you are so good at bringing people into this, like, we're just friends. And again, like you said on Watch What Happened, it's like, it's not a gotcha piece. It's here to really just dig into her story, but also, you know, what we're into today. And that's what I aspire with this gay pod. So is there anything, and I obviously won't make this a gotcha piece and make you say names, but are there ever times where you people have, like, chewing isms that surprise you? You're like, wow, I didn't expect Kristen Bell to.
Though, actually, Jesse Williams was a really loud, sloppy chewer. I was like, well, I was with you for like 2 years doing this play. I've never noticed this about you. No, I mean, we're pretty good about editing around mouth sounds, and a lot of people are very self-conscious about, you know, that. I've had some guests who have said, I don't know if I can do this podcast because I don't like eating in front of people. So I've gotten that a few times.
If you give me listen, first of all, I could eat, I think, anything in front of you.
Me too. Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah.
But if I'm doing a podcast like Dinner's on Me, or even if I'm just sharing a meal with someone like you, I'm not going to order a burger as the first choice. I do have a bit of an emotional hurdle when it comes to a two hand. First of all, I'm an erotic Jew and I need to wash my hands after we've already sat down. Second of all, I am liberal with the cats up. So I might get on the fache. And numero three, it's not the highest social level of order. Can I get the burger? Yeah, I'm probably going to get, like,
that's what I've done many times. Yep.
I love a burger, though. But
I do like it when people just lean in and go for it, though. You know?
All right. Well, once I have the opportunity to be on a food podcast, I'm going to take that as a vote of confidence, and I'm gonna dick down that burger brown bitch. Well, listen, I do need to ask you another famous podcast question, Jesse, okay. Which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
Oh God. Okay. Jesus Christ. Olivia Colman.
Jesus Christ. Olivia, can we talk about the half second beat you took in between?
Well, there was like nine people who like suddenly came to the front of my head, and I was like, I just got to choose one. It was very Sophie's Choice.
And you made the right one. See, okay, so when I look at Olivia, actually, this is a great question. When you say Olivia Colman, what is the first IMDb credit that you think of when you're like, oh, she deserves to be saved?
The favorite. I mean, I've been a fan of hers for a very long time. And the first thing I saw her in was Broadchurch, which is, you know, a drama, a BBC drama. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize she was as funny as she is. Also, The Mother, she was incredible in The Mother. Is that what it's called, The Mother? It was a film that she was in recently. And like, she wasn't even on the radar of being considered for an Oscar. And then she got like a Best Actress nomination. She's so great. She's so great.
Why it's such a good answer, and we haven't had enough on the podcast, is because, like you said, she can handle the deep drama, but she's also one of the funniest fucking people you've ever seen. And it's would be against my religion to not talk about the coming out scene in, what is it, Love, Simon? Have you seen that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's Heartstopper. God, I'm canceled.
Heartstopper. Yes, with Connor, yes.
Yes. Oh my God. I love that you have saved her. Is your, since the children have been brought up, your style of parenting, how similar is it to Mitch from Modern Family versus Realité?
Oh God. I don't know if I ever got to know how Mitch really is as a parent.
Or maybe how he would have approached it, and how are you cool dad, or is, which between you and Justin, which one is fun?
We're both fun, but I'm probably more carefree. I think Justin's more of like, okay, now we mean business. Now, like, Justin has to kind of remind us that he's like, okay, you guys need to wrap this up now. I'm like, but we're playing. Like, I'm just like with Beckett. I was like, yeah, we're gonna play for a little while longer. But I
what
do
are you
think,
called?
Go ahead.
Go on.
I'm Papa, Dada, and Papa, and I'm Papa. I think Mitch was, I probably have similar parenting styles at the end of the day, probably.
Were you always on the kid train? I know you've said that you were sort of waiting for Justin to hit that point, but was it like always you wanted kids?
Mm-mm, no, I think for me, I mean, just being 10 years older, I mean, I'll be 49 this year. So I just, I think I grew up not really having that. There was no couples in my life or even on TV that I found aspirational as far as like growing up and having kids. And you know, we were, marriage equality was something that I really didn't see ever coming to fruition. And, you know, for Justin, who's 10 years younger than me, he grew up at a time where like those things were a reality. And like, we were just farther along with, you know, gays represented on television. I mean, maybe not in the way that, you know, is a couple, you know, with a long history like Mitch and Cam were, but like, you know, Will and Grace was around, and like there was places to look on pop culture to like see representations of like who you might be able to be, even if they were exaggerated versions of yourself.
Right.
And I just didn't have that. So like, I think Justin actually opened up my mind to the possibility of kids, and that was something to strive for.
It's so amazing to see your family grow and your projects grow. And I just really mean this, you know, as we have to sadly finish this episode, it is sometimes in my mind, it feels like an impossibility to create the sort of life that we crave and deserve. And I look at you and I'm like, you know what? He came from this small town of Albuquerque. He moved to New York. You've now, you know, done all these things for the community. And it just like makes me feel like it is possible, and you just got to follow your fucking bliss, and the universe is going to do her thing. So, Jesse, thank you for coming on. That's a Gay Ass Podcast, and I'm going to ask you your final question that you were not prepped on to round us out, which is, if international mail made you a fagatrini, a gay girl, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, what's keeping you gay today? Is it a Broadway star? Is it a Twitter thought? Is it a burger brunch? What's keeping you gay, girl?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, all of Broadway is doing a great job. All of it. And then also the recent Barbra Streisand memoir.
Wow. All how many hours? Like
all 48 hours of that Barbra Streisand memoir bought me a lot more time.
Well, Babs will continue to make us gay for as long as she is on this earth and for generations after. Jesse, thank you for coming on, and tell the listeners where to follow you, where to find the pod, and anything else you'd like to share.
Well, you could find me on Instagram at Jesse Tyler. I think there's a TikTok too. Justin runs it. I don't even know.
Go off, Justin, social media man.
And my podcast, which you could find wherever you listen to your podcast, is called Dinner's on Me. Me being Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
Dinner's on Jesse, and I will see you across the table one day with a burger. Mark my fucking words. And thank you again.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you for listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, go tag us on social media at Jesse Tyler is Jesse's handle, and I'm at Eric Wills. And if you want more gay ass episodes, go to the Patreon where we interview guests about their sex lives. I bring on my husband, Matt, and more. It's been a little slow the past couple weeks because of show craziness for the Netflix festival, but now that that is over, we're ramping back up with more sex episodes, and you can get more inside scoop there about the upcoming guests for That's a Gay Ass Live show in New York City, June 28th, baby. It's going to be a pride show at Chelsea Music Hall, and the tickets go on sale today. See you next week for another gorgeous gay ass guest.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.